Then I grabbed the mirror and the whole thing came crashing down. Jay entered the bus with his girlfriend. I didn't realize it at the time, but in my whirlwind of destruction, I guess I slammed into her. Jay yelled at me, and I told him to shut the fuck up. I said something like, "It's my bus. I'm gonna do what the fuck I want. You don't like it? Go somewhere else." And suddenly I found myself in a chokehold. I tried to struggle out of it, but Jay's pretty strong, and I was pretty drunk. I fought until I couldn't take it anymore, and then I went limp and gave up. I broke into tears. The party was over. Patty and Dave awkwardly bailed. Jay let me go, and I told him about Aaron and the phone call before the show. It's a sign of true friendship when you can be a total asshole to your friend, he can choke you out, and you can still spend the rest of the night hanging out and crying. It was one of the darkest nights of my life. Even after the chokehold, I was really glad to have Jay there with me. Before I left for the Warped Tour that summer, I got a one-bedroom apartment, which was pointless because as soon as I got home, Aaron convinced me to give our marriage another shot. We tried couples therapy, we tried living apart, we didn't give up without a fight, or two, or several hundred. We had a lot of good years together. We got a great kid out of the deal, but it was time to call it quits. The silver lining of moving out and living as a bachelor again meant I could fully indulge in as much SM debauchery as I could handle. During the 2009 Warped Tour, I rented a dungeon in downtown LA and hosted a party with a bunch of friends and members of the Vandals, Sum 41, and Alkaline Trio, and their girlfriends. The moment I stepped into the dungeon, I knew which dominatrix was in charge. There were five hot doms in leather and latex waiting for us, but one of them carried herself like she owned the place. And in fact, she did. With bright red hair, socially offensive tattoos, and milky white skin, she reminded me of all my adolescent crushes. She was a cross between Wendy O. Williams, Becky Bondage, and Magenta from Rocky Horror. Her name was Goddess Soma. Soma had a slave named Boy, a 20-year-old lesbian who gender-identified as male. Soma wasn't a NoFX fan, but Boy was. And he was also a huge Alkaline Trio fan. He had their logo tattooed on his arm. So when I walked in with Matt Skiba, Boy freaked the fuck out. Soma beat up a bunch of the girls, but seemed to go out of her way to avoid disciplining me. She put some other doms on me. One of them sliced open a habanero pepper and shoved it in my ass. I was blindfolded, and I didn't know what was going on. I thought to myself, that's one of the smallest butt plugs I've ever felt. And then the juice from the pepper hit my anal membranes. Yep, they burned just as much down there. It was a fucking great party. At one point, I found myself standing naked in the kitchen, even though the other 20 people in the room were all clothed. You would think it would be like that nightmare we've all had about showing up naked at school, but it was just pleasantly weird. At the end of the night, Boy told me Goddess Soma wants to see you in her bedroom, and no one gets to go into Soma's bedroom. This was a sacred invitation. When I went in, Soma ordered me to put my face between the legs of another dom, Mr. Suzette. While my face was being smothered by Suzette's panties, Soma strapped on a pretty medium-sized purple dildo, played the Ziggy Stardust album on her stereo, and fucked the hell out of my ass. You tend to remember somebody when your first date involves David Bowie and ass rape. But Soma stayed in my mind mostly because after our session we sat and talked. I had visited other pro doms before. Aaron was okay with it as long as I never fucked anyone, and I never did. But usually I would go in for a session, pay, and then leave. This was the first time I was beaten by someone I could also hang out with. Soma was smarter and more well-read than anyone I had met in the SM scene, or any scene for that matter. And it didn't hurt that she was super fucking hot. She invited me to come down and hang out at the dungeon whenever I was in town. Aaron and I were already separated, but we began official divorce proceedings in January 2010. And I moved in with Soma pretty soon after. We rented a pale yellow house perched on a hill in La Cañada that was built in the 70s and looked like something out of a Grimm's fairy tale. Soma and I took the master bedroom on the lower floor. Boy had a room upstairs. My friend Big John from the Warped Tour and his dom girlfriend Nikki Nefarious moved into the guest house. And a kinky black dude named Culpepper lived over the garage. It was like a polyamorous version of the Waltons. It was for sure the craziest and most hedonistic year of my life. Soma would bring home girls for both of us to party with. A couple of times, Selma and her goth girlfriend Drea beat the shit out of me and raped me, which may sound awesome, but it was actually kind of rough. Selma had a bell she would ring to summon Boy to her room and then command him to do the dishes, shine her boots, or help her dress. Film crews often stopped by to shoot SM photo sessions or videos featuring Selma and her many friends. We had a tradition on Sundays. Sunday was orgy day. One night we had an orgy with Selma, Drea, Boy, and two other female submissives that went until 9 in the morning. Then a film crew walked in and said, "Ah, you guys started without us." Just to be clear, in our orgies, Selma is the one fucking all the girls. My penis is exclusively hers, aside from supervised hand or blowjobs now and then. We also spent plenty of long nights with our friends at Selma's dungeon in downtown L.A. It was the dungeon where Nikki Nefarious tied me to a table one night, and Selma produced a scalpel. She lovingly carved a large, bold S into my inner thigh. She had pushed me to a new limit of pain and intimacy and had permanently marked me as her own. It was one of the most beautiful moments of my life and a truly emotional experience for everyone in the room. All of us were weeping by the end of it. Fuck all the paperwork and all the lawyers. That incision was a moment when, for me, my divorce was truly final. I now belong to someone else. Polyamory is a fine way to live, but once the novelty wore off, I started to find the other people in our bedroom a distraction. I wanted to be with Selma, and no one else. After about a year, Selma and I moved to a different house in Glendale, and everyone else went their separate ways. I learned more about SM over the next year or two than I had learned in the previous 30. Nipple clamps became as much a part of my routine on stage as my line of coke before the encore. Selma came on tour with me and would cinch my balls with rope during our set. At the Roskilde Festival in Denmark, they had easels set up near the backstage tents, so Selma was painting and I was licking her pussy out in the open. Later, I snuck into one of the catering tents and stole a spatula and a wooden spoon, and we found an empty tent with a couch and some tables in it. She beat me with the new tools and strangled my balls with a piece of twine she found in the tent. Three festival-goers poked their heads in and watched us for a while. One girl even joined in on the spanking. When we played the Pukkelpop Festival in Belgium later that summer, Selma used a gas mask to cut off my air and latex mittens to bind my hands while she whipped me in our dressing room. The festival ended, and one of the organizers politely knocked on the door and asked us to clear out. When we got dressed and opened the door, we found 10 security guards lined up and waiting for us. I still had the rubber mittens on as they escorted us onto the bus. During the Folsom Street Fair, an annual gathering of BDSM fetishists in San Francisco that draws over 400,000 people, we were eating with friends at a Thai restaurant, and I went down on Selma under the table. It was one of the only times I've ever seen Selma get embarrassed. She borrowed some ropes from Nikki, and as you would do, she tied me up in the Thai restaurant. My shirt was already off, so she snapped on some nipple clamps and then took the candle that was on the table and dripped hot wax on my chest while we waited for our food. The waiters were hardly bothered at all. They had probably seen plenty of crazy shit that day. Earlier in the day, Selma had met a new submissive named Juliet, and we brought her home after the fair. We made her kneel beside our bed and read us erotic stories while we fucked. Selma cruelly mocked her as she read. She'd say, "You wish you were getting fucked," or "You'll never be loved by anyone." Then she leaned over and slapped Juliet across the face and said, "Read better." When we were finished, we told her to sleep in the closet. Selma and I were both flying to Chicago, but I had to fly from San Francisco and meet her at LAX before connecting. We decided ahead of time we would pretend not to know each other. She got on the plane first. I walked on 5 minutes later. It was a full flight and we were sitting in coach. I had the window seat, she had the middle, and an older guy in a business suit had the aisle. As the plane took off, I made small talk with Selma, as though I was trying to pick her up. And she kept shooting me down like I was a nuisance. "I play in this punk band, NoFX." "Oh? I've never heard of you." She was reading a book. "What are you reading about?" "BDSM." "Like what?" "Well, I'm a professional dom, and I'm doing some research." I could tell that the businessman was starting to eavesdrop. "What kind of things does a professional dominatrix do? You really want to know?" "Sure." She pulled her carry-on bag from under the seat and took out some rope. She tied my arms to the armrests, tied my legs together, blindfolded me, and on went the nipple clamps. I was wearing shorts, so she reached up my thigh and put clothespins on my balls. The businessman hit the flight attendant call button. Are there any other seats? Sorry, full flight. He buried his nose in a newspaper and turned away as much as he could while we made out next to him. After a while, Soma put my travel pillow around my neck, and I took a nap, while still tied up, blindfolded, clamped, and clothespinned. You would think there would be some sort of FAA regulation against being tied up with clothespins on your balls, but none of the flight attendants said a word to us. I guess the FAA never considered that scenario when they were making up the rules. When I was a kid, holding up a tape recorder to the TV speaker to record the Rocky Horror Picture Show, there was a lyric that always stuck with me. Don't dream it, be it. It ran through my head for years as I held myself back, ashamed of my fetishes and afraid of what people might think if I truly opened up. And I'm not just talking about BDSM. One night when I was 15, I slept over at my friend Chris Prettyman's house. His mom had to take him somewhere in the morning, and while they were out, I went into his mom's bedroom and found a pair of leather pants. There was something about the smell and the sensation of the leather against my skin. I squeezed into the pants, locked myself in the bathroom, even though I was alone in the house, and jerked off as I looked at myself in the mirror. I never told a soul. I didn't know what it all meant. At the time, the world, let alone the homophobic gay-bashing LA punk scene, wasn't all that enlightened about cross-dressing. Anything vaguely feminine made you gay in most people's eyes. My dad always said if I ever came home with an earring, he would rip it out of my ear. And he threw the word faggot around a lot. I didn't have any homosexual desires, but did wanting to wear women's clothes make me a faggot? Cross-dressing wasn't an obsession or anything. Out of my top 20 fantasies, it probably ranked somewhere around 18. So I left it unexplored for a long time. Bondage was one thing, but anything that feminized me still felt taboo. Fast forward 20 years later to when I was with Aaron, and I was finally brave enough to put on latex stockings, or maybe a PVC maid's outfit from time to time. She usually humored me, but one day we were arguing about something, and she hissed at me, "And by the way, you look stupid dressed like a girl." It instantly crushed me. I said, "Do you know what you just did? I can never dress like that again." I trusted her with my most vulnerable secret, and she humiliated me with it. She didn't mean for her words to shatter my confidence the way they did, but the damage was done. There's no coming back after that. She felt guilty and tried to get me to dress up on other occasions. "Why don't you try this on? Oh, this dress will look cute on you." But I was never able to emotionally trust her again. She thought I looked stupid, and maybe she was right. So many people with secret fetishes feel shame or alienation. I didn't feel ashamed of my fetishes. I was fine with being a pervert. I felt ashamed of my own fear. I kept saying to myself, "You're a fucking coward. You're not living how you want to live." Even into my 40s, I kept hearing those Rocky Horror lyrics in my head. Don't dream it. Be it. Years later, Soma helped me conquer my fear. Bit by bit, she encouraged my cross-dressing. Some high heels here, a corset there. And then one day, I asked her what she wanted for her birthday, and she said, "I want you to be my girlfriend for the whole weekend." She shaved my body, dressed me, and did my makeup. She wouldn't let me look at myself the entire time. 3 hours later, she put me in front of a mirror. My knees went weak, my stomach flipped, and my hand drew itself to my heart. I didn't cry, but I was close. I said, "I can't believe it. I look beautiful." Soma corrected me, "You look fucking gorgeous." We had the best lesbian sex ever. It was supposed to be my birthday gift to her, but she had given me the best gift I've ever received. I still held back from going public about cross-dressing. Getting beaten bloody or locked in a puppy cage, I would brag about that shit all day. But feminization was still something I was scared for others to know about. NoFX fans should have seen it coming. For years, if someone threw a bra on stage, I would put it on. I would convince the band to dress in drag for our Halloween and New Year's Eve shows. I wore kilts, but I was still a coward, hiding behind the safety of a joke. Finally, in 2015, I was wearing a pink nightie in my hotel room in Luxembourg, and I decided I wasn't going to take it off. I wore the nightie to dinner and then to our show with Lagwagon. It wasn't a costume, it wasn't a joke, it was me dressing the way I wanted to dress. And no one cared. Joey Cape told me I looked badass. Someone backstage poked fun at me, and Melvin told them to shut the fuck up. When pictures of me hit the internet, Fletcher from Pennywise texted me, "That's punk as fuck, dude." From that night on, I was truly liberated. No more hiding. I walked through Heathrow Airport in drag and didn't give a fuck what people thought. Punks are supposed to shock people. My pink mohawk doesn't get half as many stares as my pink nightie. If you're a woman out there hearing this, all I can say is that you should encourage your man to explore himself. Don't shut him down. Don't humiliate him. Wanting to wear lace or nylon or satin or latex doesn't make someone gay or transgender. All guys ever get to wear is cotton, and that's boring as fuck. And if you're a guy out there torturing yourself over your desire to crossdress, you should know that you're not fucked up and you're not alone. Talk it over with your partner, and if they don't accept you for who you are, then find someone else who will. You only live once. You owe it to yourself to explore what makes you happy. Give yourself over to absolute pleasure. Don't dream it. Be it.
Chapter 110, Melvin. Despite the fact that our album covers and t-shirt designs regularly featured images of dominatrixes, I was completely oblivious to Mike's love of S&M for almost 2 decades of our friendship. I didn't even think much of it when he first suggested visiting an S&M club in Sydney on our second tour of Australia. Mike was so excited about the idea and kept talking to everyone we met about how to find it and what the details were while recruiting friends and members of the opening band to join us. I thought his interest in the club was the same as mine. It would be a change of pace. By that point, we were sick of going to punk bars after every single show, so this seemed like a more unique way to spend an evening. The club was similar to most nightclubs, aside from the people milling about in leather S&M outfits and the equipment designed for tying people up in the middle of everything. A dominatrix whipped willing members of the crowd, but I don't think Mike even participated in a beating that night. We all watched Ben from the band Body Jar go up and get spanked and whipped instead, most likely at Mike's urging. It looked incredibly painful, but as I'd hoped, it was a unique way to spend our evening. We went to similar clubs in 2 other towns in the same tour. Mike never volunteered for spanking, so I still didn't connect the dots. On our tour of Japan later that year, Mike found yet another club for us and our friends from the Swinging Udders to visit. By that point, I felt more comfortable in the clubs, and I thought I knew roughly what to expect. Always open-minded to new experiences, I volunteered for a beating. I was bound, blindfolded, and ball-gagged before I knew what was happening. Once my hands were tied, the reality of not being able to move set in, and I wasn't comfortable with the situation anymore. But before I could process my own discomfort, the dominatrix undid my pants and yanked them down around my ankles, leaving me completely naked in front of all my friends and quite a few strangers. It went from uncomfortable to seriously uncomfortable in a matter of moments. And then she shoved a dildo up my ass. I don't know how big it was, but as far as my rectum was concerned, it seemed like the Guinness World Record holder for biggest dildo ever manufactured in human history. Uncomfortable was no longer applicable to the situation. Violated was more appropriate. The ball gag kept me from saying anything. The ropes around my hands kept me from doing anything. The blindfold and the loud music prevented me from knowing what else was going on around me or what kind of reactions my friends were having to my humiliation. I suffered through some spanking and whipping, and finally the dildo was extracted. I was untied and left to pull up my own pants as I rejoined my friends. There was no applause or laughter or any signal that what had just happened was all in good fun. People had a hard time making eye contact with me. Or maybe it was the other way around. None of us spoke about it again, ever. The next time we returned to Japan, I saw Mike finally volunteer for a beating, and it finally clicked in my head what had been going on all along. Mike didn't just volunteer, he went all in. I was taken aback by how fierce of a whipping he was able to endure, and how the same spanking and exhibitionism that had brought me such misery seemed to bring him such pleasure. This wasn't a random night of fun. This was his passion. Over the ensuing years, I've joined Mike at a bunch of S&M clubs and parties all over the world. I've seen so many whips and ropes and paddles and gags and needles and plastic wrap and dripping candles and nipple clamps and restraints and corsets and red handprints on Mike's ass that it's become normal to me. And after hearing so many stories about his sexual experiments with Aaron and later with Soma, it went beyond normal to mundane. I never much enjoyed picturing my buddy naked, so I tuned him out most of the time. Although, I must say the story about the saline injections definitely held my attention.
Chapter 111, Mike. I never travel with drugs because I don't want to get caught at the airport. So if I ever have any coke or X left after a night of partying, I tuck it in the pages of the Bible in my hotel room. I like to picture someone alone in a strange city, lost and looking for answers, opening the Bible and having my leftover drugs fall into his or her lap. I consider it my missionary work. In 2010, me first and the Gimme Gimmes played the Fest in Gainesville, Florida. I stayed up late after the show, bankrupting James from against me in a poker game, but I had a flight to catch at 6:30 a.m., so I just stayed up all night. I had bought a bunch of drugs in anticipation of a large-scale party, and I had about a gram and a half of coke left over. But instead of leaving it in the Bible, I went to the hotel lobby to catch my cab to the airport and tossed it in a planter box on the way out. Then I tweeted that I had hidden the drugs in the lobby and sent my Twitter followers on what I like to call a treasure hunt. I heard at least 50 people went searching for the treasure, but one of the guys from Municipal Waste was up really early, or really late, and got the tweet before the rest of the crowd, so he scored the prize. Nice job, Tony. My flight that morning was to Miami, where I would meet Soma and connect to a flight to Jamaica. We were headed to Kink in the Caribbean, a week-long version of the Folsom Street Fair at an all-inclusive beach resort. I called Soma from the Gainesville airport to let her know I'd be boarding soon. She asked me, "You have your toys with you, right?" "Yes, ma'am." "Go to the bathroom. I want you to stick a butt plug in your ass and put nipple clamps on your tits until you see me." When you enter into a dominant, submissive relationship, you discuss your limits early on. The agreement is that the dom gives the orders and the sub can't refuse any order within those pre-agreed limits. The thrill of the relationship is trusting someone to push you to the very edge and catch you right before you go over. If the sub refuses the dom's orders, there's no trust and it's no fun. So when your dom tells you to stick a butt plug up your ass before you board an hour-long flight, you go into the bathroom of the Gainesville Regional Airport and you lube the fuck up. Yeah! Did I mention she also made me put on a cock ring? Because after a gaggle of punks who had just been at the fest bought me enough drinks on the plane, I certainly mentioned it to them. I told the two kids sitting behind me that I had nipple clamps on and an ass plug in, too. They didn't believe me until I pulled up my shirt and showed them the clamps. After that, they took my word about the butt plug and the cock ring. An hour is a long fucking time for all that stuff to be on and in your body. So when I met Soma at the Miami airport, she mercifully allowed me to remove the butt plug and the nipple clamps. But when we went through security to get on our flight to Jamaica, the metal detector went off. They wanted me down, and it beeped at crotch level. Shit, I still had the cock ring on. I explained what was going on, and they took me into a private room and made me take the ring off. The poor TSA guy had to take the cock ring in his rubber-gloved hand and inspect it closely to make sure I wasn't hiding anything dangerous. He showed the leather and metal cock ring to a colleague and pointed at me. Once everything was cleared up and I put my clothes back on, the colleague asked for my autograph. He was a NoFX fan. I've become more open about my sexuality, but some situations still make me uneasy. Kink in the Caribbean wasn't one of those situations. We walked into the resort, and the first thing I saw was a guy in a rubber sack and a gas mask coming down the water slide. His dom caught him in the pool and graciously allowed him not to drown. I belonged here. When we hit the pool ourselves, Soma and our friend Domina Angelina tied me up and dunked me under the water and then made me wear my fingerless rubber mittens to get drinks for them. Of course, I spilled everything, and Soma made me walk around the pool and ask every dom there to slap me as punishment. Each slap was harder than the last. Dominatrixes do not like being outdone. There were about 100 kinky people at the resort, mostly couples in crazy rubber outfits and some infamous pro-doms. Every night there were SM shows, fire shows, kinky cabaret shows, latex karaoke, outdoor dungeon parties, and slave auctions. During the day, there were latex-themed pool parties and some very informative classes. I studied proper bullwhip technique. It's all in the wrist. After a week of pure debauchery, Soma and I were finishing our night up at 5 a.m. with our South African friends Paul and Joanne, watching the waves crash into a cement pier by the beach. An offshore hurricane had pushed in a huge swell. We walked to the end of the pier, where Soma tied me to a metal light post, and Joanne bound Paul's hands behind his back. The waves swept over the pier as Soma wailed on me with her flogger and fucked me with a strap-on, while Joanne repeatedly dunked Paul's head, Clockwork Orange style, underwater in a nearby cement trough. When the girls finally released us, we all sat on the edge of the pier, holding hands and watching the sunrise. And then a huge wave came in and nearly knocked us all into the ocean, so we retreated to safety. We were definitely never bored. SM was never the same routine for us. Soma is a queen of improvisation. One day Soma said, "I'm going to make you feel what I have to go through every month. I'm putting you on birth control." She's my dom. I had to say yes. I was so bummed as I watched her punch a pill out of her little circular package. But I was a good sub, so I took my medicine. After a while, I started to really worry. I had no idea what these things were doing to my body, and since I wasn't getting high from them, it hardly seemed worth the risk. I finally freaked out after a couple days. "We don't know what these pills could be doing to me." She looked at me with a sinister smile and said, "They're just sugar pills, sugar." Every birth control packet has several placebo pills to coincide with the time when a woman is on her period. Those were the pills she was giving me. But in my mind, I was on birth control the whole time. SM isn't all about whips and leather. It's about the mindfuck, too. And Soma is a mindfuck expert. Once we decided to do a role play in which I would be one of Soma's new clients, I went to her website and filled out an application form and booked a session with her. I showed up to the dungeon on time, and she introduced herself and brought me inside. She asked me questions about what I liked and what my limits were, as if she hadn't been testing them for over a year. She tied me to a gynecological examination table, put my feet up in stirrups, blindfolded me, and made me snort a line of ketamine. Suddenly, I felt a needle pierce my ballsack, accompanied by a burning sensation. She had pierced my nipples with needles during our play sessions before, so I thought she was just going to another level by piercing my junk. When my hour appointment was up, she pulled off my blindfold and held a mirror up to my crotch. It wasn't a piercing. She had injected 250 cc of saline into my scrotum and blown it up to the size of a softball. I tried to walk around, but it felt like there was a warm water balloon dangling between my legs. It went away over the course of the next 12 hours, but every now and then I'd forget about it, go to scratch my balls, and frighten myself. It wasn't a turn-on. I couldn't have got a boner if I wanted to. It was just one of those beautiful mindfucks. Like punk rock, it was pointless self-destruction. Yeah! The mindfuck, however, goes both ways. After a show in Toronto on NoFX's 2011 Canadian tour, Soma and I were playing in our hotel room, and we decided to switch. I would be the dom, and she would be the sub. I tied her to a chair and blindfolded her. Thanks to some prior planning and perfect timing, Jay Walker entered the room. Soma freaked out a bit. "What's going on? Who's here?" It was a total loss of control for her, and she may have been somewhat self-conscious since her outfit was entirely transparent latex. I pulled off the blindfold and showed her it was Jay. I reminded her about the S she had carved in my leg and told her that tonight it was my turn to mark her. Jay had brought his tattoo gun. I pulled down her bottom lip, and because I often play the daddy role in our relationship, Jay inked the word "daddies" on the inside of her lip. I already belonged to her. Now she belonged to me. At the end of that Canadian tour, I hid four packages of treasure around my hotel in Vancouver and tweeted that the hunt was on before heading to the airport to fly home. While waiting for my flight, I was paged. "Michael Burkett, please come to gate 10. I thought I was getting a frequent flyer upgrade, but at the gate, there were two police officers who took me to the back room. They said they had gotten an anonymous tip that I was holding drugs. They pulled my checked bags off the plane and went through everything with a fine-tooth comb. I had gotten rid of my coke and my ecstasy, but I forgot I had two small Percocets in a coat pocket in my suitcase. Traveling with drugs is one thing. Crossing international borders with them is another. Thankfully, they missed the pills and I made it home. So that was the last ever treasure hunt. I have been told, on enough occasions that I have written multiple songs about it, that I have a problem with drugs and alcohol. Maybe I do, but is it a bad enough problem that I actually have to, God us forbid, quit? I think I can handle it. But then again, I'm sure that's what all addicts say. How does a successful guy know when he needs help? I've got enough money in the bank that it would take forever for drugs to bankrupt me. I've got friends and fans in every town on tour, so I'm rarely without an excuse to party. And as much as my bandmates might want to give me the same ultimatum I gave Smelly back in the day, it's pretty tough to replace the singer, the chief songwriter, the bass player, well, that one's not so hard, and the label owner all at once. On Christmas Eve 2011, Darla celebrated with me at my apartment in San Francisco, and then I dropped her off at Aaron's so she could celebrate Christmas Day with her mom in the morning. Soma was down in L.A. I was alone and bored. I did some coke. I drank a little. I jerked off. I took some Ambien, but the coke overpowered it and I couldn't sleep. It was the first time I stayed up all night on coke by myself. My head may have been a little cloudy, but it was enough to make me consider the idea that I had a problem. I went online and found out where the nearest AA meeting was. At 7 a.m., I drunkenly drove my Honda Odyssey minivan to a community center in Bernal Heights. 20 people sat in folding chairs telling stories about their addiction. I didn't really think of myself as one of them. I didn't need 12 steps. I just needed to dial things back a bit. And then toward the end of the meeting, someone said, "Merry Christmas!" And I remembered what day it was. Maybe a step or two wouldn't hurt. When I'm home and around my daughter, I'm always able to put on the brakes. But it's hard for me to play a show these days without my Valium vodka coke combo. And sometimes it just makes sense to party. Like when an old friend comes to town, or when a new band signs to Fat, or when it just happens to be a nice sunny afternoon. It's hard for me to see a reason to go sober when my doctor tells me I'm healthy, and when some of my best memories are from nights I barely remember. Then I find myself at an AA meeting on Christmas morning, and I have to wonder if I really know what I'm doing, or if my endless rationalizations will point me toward the same fate as Tony Sly. Tony was a singer and lead guitarist for No Use for a Name, and a very close friend for over 20 years. He wasn't a good guy. He was a great guy. In 2012, he took a lethal combination of painkillers and Xanax before flying home to San Francisco after an acoustic solo show in Gainesville, Florida. He arrived at his house, called his wife to let her know he had gotten in, and fell asleep. He never woke up again. I got a call at 7 a.m. from Matt, No Use's bassist, and I was sad. But those old walls were still up, and they kept the pain from hitting me for several more hours. I was eating a burger alone at a diner near my house when Eric Melvin called. I answered and said, "Melvin? Tony?" And then I completely came apart. It was probably 5 full minutes before I could get my tears under control and finish my sentence. I walked all the way to the Fat Records offices, which is about an hour on foot. When I got there, I couldn't even walk through the door. Someone saw me outside, and everyone came out to see what was wrong. We all sat on the grass and mourned together. Whatever disconnect I'd always had inside, losing Tony connected it. More than any other consequence of my drug use, more than any other death, Tony made me re-examine my habits. When someone you know dies in a drunk driving accident, you may not stop drinking, you may not stop driving, but you at least reconsider the combination. There have been nights when I've gone into sweats and thought, I hope tonight isn't that night. I've tried to tone down my partying since losing Tony, and I've learned enough lessons to be careful about quantities and mixtures, but it's not an exact science. Maybe there's something I haven't learned. I never used to second-guess myself so much. Now Tony is always in the back of my mind. It could have just as easily been me. The last song Tony ever performed on stage was a cover of Linoleum. Chapter 112, Mike. In the summer of 2003, we booked our first ever show in Iceland. The promoter warned us that no one really knew us out there, and he couldn't guarantee us much money, but we were in it for the fuck of it. When we arrived, we found out he wasn't exaggerating. We did a radio interview, and the host had never heard of our band. We went to a record store, and we weren't on the shelves. We played a bar in front of 200 curiosity seekers, and maybe 40 of them knew the songs. A lot of bands might complain about being plunged back into obscurity after playing a festival to 10,000 people or so 2 days before, but it was one of the funnest shows we've ever played. We bought a bunch of bottles of some nasty-smelling grain alcohol that the locals called Black Death, and gave it out to the crowd. Kids were cupping it in their hands as I poured shots into them. It was our National Independence Day, so after the show we went bar hopping all night with some of our newest fans, and the sun never went down. We ate whale with green peppercorn sauce. Icelanders are allowed to hunt a certain number of whales each year for food, so it's legal there. It tasted okay, but definitely not worth killing a whale for, and the puffin we ate wasn't much better. And Kent and I golfed while the rest of the band and crew went to the Blue Lagoon, a geothermal pool situated in a lava field. It was such a rad trip that we ended up giving the promoter his money back because we couldn't bear the idea of him taking a loss while we had such a good time. That's where the idea for what would eventually become NoFX Backstage Passport was born. We couldn't always afford to travel to strange countries and take a loss, but if we booked a tour of weird places, filmed a documentary about it, and put it out on DVD, maybe it would pay for itself. Kent and I discussed the whole idea and started talking to filmmakers. I had recently been interviewed for the documentary Let Them Know, the story of Youth Brigade and BYO Records, by a pair of guys named Jeff Alulis and Ryan Harlan. Everyone we talked to was jumping at the chance to make our documentary, but Jeff and Ryan were the only ones who said they would do the whole thing on the cheap, with just the two of them and no other crew. That was important. We couldn't afford to drag too many extra people around the world with us, and even if we could, we wanted the shooting to be as low profile as possible. In the end, it's pretty amazing that they got the footage they did with a team of only two, covering the whole band and crew around the clock. We officially began the tour in South America in the fall of 2006. If you've seen Backstage Passport, you know the highlights. Kent falling down shit-faced on one day, the cops kidnapping our crew in Peru, the Colombian promoter getting death threats, the kids jumping off the balconies in Chile, and then there were the moments that never made the cut, like me juggling three huge balls of cocaine in Brazil. When the South America tour was almost over, Jeff said we probably had enough material to make a 90-minute documentary, based solely on those first 2 weeks, even though we still had months of touring in dozens of other countries on the horizon. Eureka! We would sell the project as a TV series instead of a documentary. Fuse TV bought our pitch, and Jeff and Ryan and I oversaw the editing as the episodes came together. Jeff and Ryan had shot more than 600 hours of footage over the course of 14 months. Most reality shows don't come close to that. They shoot for a couple weeks tops, usually with the story in mind already. We broke the rules of reality TV by actually filming reality. We went to plenty of places where nothing happened, but after enough time on the road with no effects, the shit inevitably hit the fan. Kent puking on the Russian train, military security measures in Indonesia, busting Melvitt's head open with my bass in Israel, black people, and tiger cubs in South Africa. We had to tweak a few things in order to tell a cohesive story, like saying that we played certain countries in a different order than we really did, or making it seem like we were on the road constantly when really we toured for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and came home for weeks in between. But ultimately, the show is 90% reality and 10% massaging. Normal reality shows have those percentages reversed. The big stuff, the stuff that everyone asks about, like getting completely ripped off in Beijing and Bali, or the crew sneaking out of the Peru venue in an equipment truck, or the fight with the Israeli crowd, or anything else that was a major plot point, was absolutely real, unexpected, and never staged. Yes, we did weird green drugs in Singapore, and yes, I was the highest I've ever been in my life. Everyone asked us what the green dragon was. The guy told us it was half ketamine and half ecstasy, but who really knows what got lost in translation? One thing to remember about editing is that it goes both ways. Not only was the green dragon footage not faked, but we cut out the footage of us later that evening, doing even more of it in a stairwell of a parking garage. Not only did Hefe actually go missing before our show in Singapore, he went missing before our show the night before in Seoul as well, and apparently had to flag down some random dude and get a ride to the club on the back of a motorcycle. We cut that out too because we didn't think anyone would believe he got lost two nights in a row on the same tour. The premiere of NoFX Backstage Passport gave Fuse a 96% jump in ratings overall, and a 200% jump in ratings for the 12 to 34 demographic in that time slot. It remained one of their top-rated shows throughout its run, and was among their top five rated shows. Backstage Passport captured the essence of NoFX in a way that music, print, artwork, and live shows never quite could. When I meet someone on a golf course at a party, and they show some interest in my band, I don't give them a CD. I give them Backstage Passport. You don't have to like us or even punk rock to enjoy it. And when I think about touring any time after the mid-90s, I never think about playing some random show in the Midwest or some festival in Europe. I think of Indonesia. I think of Israel. I think about wandering through Red Square in the middle of the night. I think about playing acoustic guitar in a hotel lobby in Peru. I think about how unthinkable all of those tours were before that Iceland show. It's a tangible example of why I lead a charmed life. I went the way I wasn't supposed to go, and I ended up playing in front of 1,000 Malaysians while filming my own TV show. I say it often, but not often enough. Start a punk band, see the world.
Chapter 113, Melvin. Looking out the window of the plane, I saw the waves crashing into a black, volcanic shore and a conspicuous lack of trees. It felt more like we were landing on Mars than Iceland. I'd been looking forward to the trip for months, excited to plant the NoFX flag in a new nation. But the first day we were there, I caught a savage case of the flu and spent the whole day hovering over the toilet while everyone else swam in the Blue Lagoon. I did get to see the midnight sun and eat whale sashimi, but while Mike was inspired to venture to more uncharted touring locations by the fun he had, I was inspired by the fun I missed. Somehow I got in touch with a girl named Karen who booked bands in Hong Kong, and I lobbied Mike and Kent to set up a show there en route to Japan in 2005. My heart was set on this new adventure, so I became actively involved with the booking, staying in direct contact with Karen and working out as many details as I could before letting Kent take over. A few months later, I was on a plane, bound for redemption for my illness-spoiled opportunity. Being in Hong Kong is like walking through a James Bond movie. Everything is moving and electric and exotic and disorienting, and at any minute you feel like some shady dudes in suits are going to start some shit. We were excited to taste authentic Chinese food for the first time, so our hosts talked our way into an exclusive restaurant. Inside, the glaring, uncomfortable, fluorescent lights bounced off the renter's white walls while we ate the blandest, most overcooked food we'd ever had. And this was the nice restaurant? I don't think Mike finished his meal, but before he excused himself, we learned that our show was crossing paths with the annual Rocket Music Festival. Thousands of people would be gathered to see bands in Victoria Park, while we would be hosting 300 kids at a community center housed in a Catholic church. The band wondered why we didn't try to book ourselves on the festival bill, or why we didn't at least try to book our own show a day earlier or later. I kept my head down and pushed my mushy food around my plate. It can be a blast to play for smaller crowds in odd places, but when a third of the crowd is made up of British and American expat kids and most of the Chinese people are relegated to the back of the room, and not all that excited anyway, the show could be considered a disappointment. But the show was only part of the reason we had detoured to Hong Kong. I wanted to enjoy the type of cultural adventure I'd missed in Reykjavik. So I coordinated a band crew trip to see Hong Kong's famous Tian Tan Buddha statue. I was under the impression that it was the largest Buddha statue in the world. But at some point during lunch, our local guides corrected us and explained that it was the second largest. Second largest in the world still seemed like a big deal, but at some point during the 1 mile hike, or maybe during the 268-step ascent up the mountainside, we were corrected further. It's actually the second largest outdoor Buddha in the world. Further research has since narrowed the honor down even further. It is in fact the second largest outdoor seated Buddha made of bronze in the world. The sarcastic comments from the band and crew became more frequent as we neared the top of the mountain. But we were all still looking forward to at least touching history through this cultural relic from one of China's ancient dynasties. When we reached the statue, there was a plaque at its base. It was built in 1993. My dreadlocks are older than the Tian Tan Buddha statue. I don't think anyone in the band or crew blamed me for any of the glitches in our Hong Kong trip, but I felt responsible for all of them. I felt responsible for not knowing about the festival, I felt responsible for our mediocre dinner, and I felt responsible for dragging everyone to the first most disappointing Buddha statue in the world. I was glad I had very little to do with the planning of our backstage passport tours the following year. For all the adventures we experienced on the backstage passport tours, I can't help but feel like I squandered some once-in-a-lifetime moments. When everything was getting ugly in Peru, I was vomiting up the excess coca pisco sours I had downed earlier in the evening. When we were in the Philippines, I was too intimidated by the bomb squad inspecting our van when we arrived at the hotel to venture out into the city. NoFX will probably never return to most of the places we played in Backstage Passport, and I doubt I'll be dragging my kids to places like Manila anytime soon. In the last few years, I've become keenly aware of just how precious time is, and just how extraordinary it is that I get to go where I go and do what I do. But while I sometimes look back and wonder what I missed by staying in, I also marvel at the unlikely alignment of the universe that allowed my punk band to land me on top of the Great Wall of China. I don't know how we ended up here. I think about it all the time. What if Smelly had never rejoined the band? What if Dave Allen had remained our singer? What if Mike's head had been crushed when that truck hit our van? What if Smelly had OD'd? What if Hefe had ended up in jail for counterfeiting? What if Chelsea and I had kept our baby? What if I had been decapitated by a train while trying to flatten a penny? Or what if none of us had ever met in the first place? Those are the questions that push any potential regrets out of my mind. I can't say I should have done anything differently, except maybe paying more attention to my guitar playing a bit sooner. Maybe I'd be 15 or 20 years further along with my technical ability. Maybe I'd be helping our band's sound and songwriting process and live show. But who would have ever thought that playing guitar was something I should have focused on?
Chapter 114, Hefe. I don't know how to spell or pronounce the name of the capital of Iceland, so I'm not going to try. The name is bigger than the town itself. You could walk around the whole place in 10 minutes. That's not to say I didn't have a blast. I tripped out on all the volcanic scenery. We'd been all over the United States, Europe, Japan, and Australia. But Iceland was the first time I felt like I was stepping into a copy of National Geographic. It was more of a vacation than a tour. We went to the Blue Lagoon geothermal pool, and Limo and I slapped white mud all over our bodies. I don't know what the mud is supposed to do. It's good for your skin or something. But when some older tourist ladies asked us about it, I gave them a whole lecture about its miraculous anti-aging properties. As I rinsed the mud off my face, I said, "You should have seen me before. I'm 50 years old." They oohed and aahed. Limo shook his head and told me I was a bad man. The backstage passport tours weren't exactly a vacation, but they were definitely an adventure. The moments of relaxation were rare because we were worried about cancellations and riots and losing money. But I got to float in the Dead Sea, ride through the safari park in South Africa, and steer a boat in St. Petersburg in between all the craziness. I also went down a water slide naked with the rest of the band in Bali, but that didn't make the cut, nor did the cubed eggs the chef made us in Ecuador, or my tour of the back streets of South Korea. But then again, that happened when there were no cameras around. I left our hotel in Seoul to walk to the show, which was only a couple blocks away, but I somehow ended up walking in the wrong direction and got completely lost. I walked into several businesses, pointing to the address of the club printed on my tour itinerary, but no one had any idea what I was trying to say to them. I think at one point I may have even wandered into someone's house. The lines between commercial and residential get a little blurry in some of those alleys. Finally, some dude on a moped rolled up next to me and said he was from the club, I hopped on, and he buzzed through the streets at what seemed like top speed. Neither of us were wearing helmets as he whizzed between cars and took gnarly turns. I wanted to close my eyes, but I couldn't. We got to the club 5 minutes before stage time. I'm less surprised that I didn't die on that bike than I am that I didn't die of a heart attack after getting off it. Even after all these years of traveling with the band, the backstage passport tours showed me how much else there is out there to see and experience. I mean, I saw a fucking warthog up close. I watched The Lion King however many times and saw the animated warthog do his thing. But there I was in South Africa with a real deal warthog right in front of me. I had a lot of rock star fantasies back when I first started playing guitar, but none of them involved warthogs. Hell, none of them even involved punk. I don't know how the fuck I ended up here, and I haven't the slightest clue where we're going. I'm just riding the NoFX moped through traffic without a helmet, and hoping it doesn't kill me before I get wherever it is I'm supposed to go.
Chapter 115, Smelly. When Jeff, one of the producers of Backstage Passport, showed up at my door to film me packing, I asked him if he would be along for the whole South American tour. He said, "I'll be along for this whole year of traveling." I didn't understand what he meant. "Where else are we going?" "They didn't tell you? You guys are going all over the place. Israel, China, South Africa?" No one tells the drummer anything. But I was stoked to hear about all the travel, and it turned out to be 14 months of madness, in a good way, for once. One of my friends happens to be Pearl Jam's tour manager. When he saw the first episode of Backstage Passport with Kent falling down drunk and flopping around on the ground in Rio, he said, "Fire him." He was dead serious, but I couldn't contain my laughter. There is no way to explain how ridiculous his suggestion was, because to him, it made perfect sense. Your manager shows up drunk, you fire him. That's how it's supposed to work. It showed me what an unusual place we occupy in the music industry. Kent is the heart and soul of our whole operation. But in the eyes of the big, major label rock world, he wouldn't have made it past day one of that tour. We're an anomaly that way. Our band's dysfunction is what keeps us functioning. I've never toured with another band, so to me the chaos is normal. I wouldn't know what to do if I was suddenly surrounded by so-called professionals. It would probably kind of suck. It may have been embarrassing having guys with cameras call attention to me in every town square across 5 continents. But when the show aired, I really loved it. Not only was it a time capsule of some of our most exotic tours, it also gave me a sense of perspective. When I saw my band and my life from the third-person point of view, it made me understand just how lucky I am to have what I have. After so many years of touring, the travel and the shows can become routine. It's easy to take all those trips to Europe and Australia for granted, or to become jaded about releasing another album. But when I see myself on a TV screen petting a tiger cub or swimming in the Dead Sea, I realize that my life has turned out to be really fucking cool. My fondest memory from the Backstage Passport tours was a moment that happened off camera. At the end of the Asian leg of our tour, Ruli and I hired a boat to take us on a surf trip around some small islands off Lombok and Sumbawa in Indonesia. It was just the two of us with a captain and a couple deckhands bobbing around the ocean for 2 weeks. The crew would cast anchor in the morning, and we'd surf until we got our fill. They would make us meals between sets, and we'd spend the night sailing to the next break. The meals were usually fresh-caught fish right out of the water. There was a toilet for me and Ruli to use, but the crew guys had no problem dropping a deuce over the side of a boat while waving and smiling at us. It was refreshingly simple living. One day, we pulled into a bay near some microscopic nameless island. There were a dozen or so grass huts on the shore and some water buffalo wandering along the beach. A handful of local kids hopped in a little boat powered by an engine that looked like a weed eater and buzzed out toward us. They jumped in the water, swam over, and climbed up onto our boat. Their village was so far removed from society that they spoke their own dialect. Our Indonesian boat crew couldn't communicate with them any better than I or Ruli could. But they were so excited to have visitors, and we were happy to entertain them. We gave them cookies and hung out with them all day. We gave them a pen, and it was as if we'd handed them a magic wand. Their minds were blown as they wrote and drew and passed around their new toy. It's tempting to think about walking away from everything and living simply in a place like that, isolated from the rest of the world. I've considered it very seriously. I don't need creature comforts or indoor plumbing. I still love Costa Rica, and I've been back many times since my acid turtle experience. But even Costa Rica would be too on the grid. Maybe Nicaragua or El Salvador. Maybe I'll spend a year in one remote place and then next year somewhere else. Maybe I belong in a grass hut somewhere off the coast of Indonesia. Every now and then, I'll look at pictures I took of those kids on our boat. One of them is wearing a hat with the logo of a surf company on it that I gave him. I'm not sure if that's a mile marker of how far I've been or a signpost pointing me to an eventual destination. I keep staring at it either way.
Chapter 116, Mike. The first time an unsuspecting person ever drank my piss was at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. I had written a song called Cokie the Clown about a bitter birthday clown who gets out of rehab and takes petty revenge on his audience by dosing them with various drugs. Fat Records had a showcase at South by Southwest at Emo's, and I decided to play a solo acoustic set in character as Cokie. I also decided to play a little joke. Before the set, I put on some sloppy, sad clown makeup and a pair of floppy, oversized shoes. And Ryan from Backstage Passport filmed me peeing into an empty bottle of Patron. With the camera still rolling, Ryan followed me as I walked on stage with the bottle, poured shots, and offered them to the crowd. Everyone gulped them down without thinking twice. At the end of the set, Ryan hooked his video camera up to a TV on stage and pressed play. Everyone watched the unedited video and cheered at the sight of themselves drinking piss. Music journalists and bloggers flipped out. It seemed like every review and article about the festival had at least some mention of Cokie the Clown and the pee-drinking stunt. The story was picked up by Austin's local news channels and even by TMZ, and the Austin Health Department launched an investigation. Poor Vanessa at Fat Rec had to feel the flood of unexpected calls from the press. In so many ways, the show was a total success, but the problem was that the pee prank overshadowed the rest of the performance. After all these years, I've cultivated the reputation of punk rock funny man. I wanted to turn that image on its head with the Cokie performance, so in between songs, instead of my usual jokey banter, I told a selection of my most fucked up stories. I told the crowd about Melvin and me watching those gangsters carry that girl into the basement, and about my roommate who hung himself. I sang my orphan year after telling them about my dad's awkward funeral, and I sang an unreleased song about killing my mom. Everyone kept waiting for a punchline that wasn't coming. Some were confused, some were angry. Everyone was bummed out. People booed and yelled, "What's wrong with you?" And that's fucked up. And when I told the story about milking that girl in England, someone shouted, "Bullshit!" Bullshit was the one heckle that got me. I guess when a person tells one fucked up story, it sounds believable. But a series of fucked up stories, back to back, sounds too weird to be true. Collectively, NoFX has enough fucked up stories that no one ever knows what to believe about us. And it's hard to blame them. It wasn't even real pee in that Patron bottle. Months after the Cokie performance, we released a video that showed how Kent switched the bottles off screen with some simple misdirection. But the truth never gained the same traction as the initial joke. To this day, people still think they drank my urine. But when it comes to our history, we don't make up or embellish our stories. Our memories for small details may not be photographic, and we've changed a few names to protect the innocent, but everything you've read in this book is true. Well, except for the part about killing my mom, according to my lawyer. Happy now, Stacy? Almost all of it can be confirmed by outside sources, and the parts that can't aren't worth fabricating. NoFX likes a good joke as much as the next band, but deep down, our fans know that. In the end, NoFX will always tell you the fucking truth, whether you want to hear it or not. But again, I don't blame people for doubting us. Even the Cokie reveal video is still not the whole story that evening. As I peed into that Patron bottle before the set, everything was very rushed and tense. I only had one empty bottle and one full bladder and one shot at making the video look good. We were so focused on making a smooth switch and getting me on stage with a prop bottle that we left behind the actual Patron bottle that was actually filled with my actual piss. Later on, when we went back into the bar area to retrieve it, It was gone. Someone at the show must have seen it, thought they scored a free bottle of tequila, and snuck off with it. I left the show with my weirdness barometer still broken and a smile on my face, because someone, somewhere out there, drank my pee.
This is Hefe. We hope you have enjoyed this production of NoFX, The Hepatitis Bathtub and Other Stories. Read by Fat Mike Burkett, Eric Melvin, Eric Smelly Sandin, and Aaron L. Hefe of Beta. With special guests, Jello Biafra and Tommy Chong. This program was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Recorded at Motor Studio in San Francisco by Scott Sherritt and Josh Garcia. The Village Studios in Los Angeles by Jared Nugent. And at Maple Studios in Santa Ana by Scott Sherritt and Cameron Webb. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. All music by NoFX, used with permission. NoFX, The Hepatitis Bathtub and Other Stories, is also available in print and digital formats from DeCapo Press, the Perseus Books Group, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by NoFX. Production copyright 2016 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property, and they will fuck you up. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
They're down for the guys, Holmes.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.